From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The partial government shutdown continues. President Trump is visiting McAllen, Texas, along the Mexican border. No additional negotiations scheduled between the president and Democratic leaders. Trump's reportedly still considering declaring an emergency to fund a border wall. Meanwhile, Mexico's dealing with its own crisis, a gasoline shortage, the latest after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Your day's going well so far. Coming up, Governor Gavin Newsom unveils his proposed state budget. We'll hear any remarks he makes. He's scheduled to speak shortly after 11 o'clock. We'll have a wide range of guests talking about the governor's spending priorities in that proposal. That's coming up next hour, Air Talk, right here on KPCC. This hour, we begin with the ongoing impasse over border wall funding. We're approaching 3 weeks of a partial government shutdown. Yesterday, a brief meeting between President Trump and Democratic leaders abruptly ended with the president leaving the room. Trump denied Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's claim that the president had a temper tantrum and slammed his hand on the table before leaving. This morning, Trump said, "I didn't smash the table. I should have." The president also, in speaking with reporters before he boarded the helicopter to go to the border, said, "I didn't rant. I didn't rave like you reported. I mean, some of the newspapers." And then Schumer always has his standard lie. He had a temper tantrum. "I don't have temper tantrums. I really don't." But it plays to his narrative, but it's a lie. The president also, as you heard on NPR News, indicating he is strongly considering declaring an emergency along the U.S.-Mexico border so that he could come up with the funding for a border wall. Joining us to talk about the very latest developments, Kevin Diaz, who's Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle and Hearst newspapers. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Hey, good to be with you.
Let's start, first of all, with the president's visit to the border. I saw that in a meeting with news anchors before he gave his primetime Tuesday night speech, he referred to this as a photo op. What does the president seem to want to get out of this visit?
Well, he wants a backdrop for a wall, and there is some fencing, there is some wall in McAllen where he's going. The idea of it being a photo op, though, gives people there on the ground a pause, because I just spoke with the mayor of McAllen yesterday, Jim Darling. The last thing they want to be, these communities along the border, is to be a backdrop or a symbol of all that's wrong with the immigration system. These people see their communities as fairly safe, low crime, things are tranquil. Yes, there's trafficking, but they don't see themselves as wanting to be like the poster children for all that ails American immigration problems.
Well, and this also, as I understand it, the county where McAllen sits is actually enjoying low crime rates historically, and compared to other communities along the border that are having serious crime problems, this is not one of those places.
Right. That's been one of their talking points. Interestingly, it was a very big talking point in the Senate race of Beto O'Rourke when he was challenging Ted Cruz for the Senate race in Texas last year, talking about El Paso being one of the safest cities in America. And that's been a talking point for local government officials all along the border for a long time, that these are not, they don't see themselves as communities in crisis, and they don't want to be portrayed that way.
Let's listen to one of the comments that President Trump made this morning. This was before he boarded his aircraft to go to McAllen, Texas, along the border.
When during the campaign, I would say Mexico's going to pay for it. Obviously, I never said this, and I never meant they're going to write out a check. I said they're going to pay for it. They are. They are paying for it with the incredible deal we made called the United States, Mexico, and Canada, USMCA deal. It's a trade deal. It has to be approved by Congress. It probably will be, other than maybe they even hold that up because they want to have, you know, they want to do as much harm as they can, only because of the 2020 presidential election. So Mexico is paying for the wall indirectly.
Those are the sound of the rotors on Marine One there in the background. The president addressing the issue of Mexico paying for the border wall. And Kevin Diaz, there's some interesting back and forth on a border barrier, because I know that there was video of a steel wall actually being cut through with a saw. The president was asked about that by reporters this morning before he boarded Marine One. The president said, well, that wasn't one of the prototypes from my administration. That was a predecessor's. But even down to the detail of what a wall would be now, you know, subject to this kind of back and forth. Is there any indication that Democrats and the president are going to be meeting again in the coming days?
Well, I'm not sure, but it's interesting. You bring up the idea of, you know, the shifting versions of what a wall actually would be or how much it's needed. I suspect that one of the keys to this could be something that was said by the Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick yesterday when he told the business group in Texas that really there's – and he was Trump's guy in Texas. Dan Patrick was his campaign guy. And he himself said that there's probably only the need for about 200 miles of additional barrier, fencing, walls. Folks in Texas tend to be fairly agnostic about what you want to call it. But almost everybody agrees that, you know, in some places it makes sense, in other places it doesn't. But for Trump's guy in Texas to say, well, you know, maybe we don't need exactly, you know, one long barrier from Brownsville to El Paso. Maybe I'm being unduly optimistic, but that may be a key. Maybe that's a compromise point, but I don't know.
All right. And of course, we have government workers who are foregoing their paychecks, having to work with their compensation deferred until after the government restarts. And that includes the Border Patrol officials he's meeting with on the border, doesn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, it does. They're working without pay, which is one of the central ironies of this whole situation. Yet the Border Patrol union has strongly backed the president in the standoff. I'm sure most of your listeners saw the little press hit he did a couple of days ago with the Border Patrol leaders in the White House press room, you know, saying they backed the president 100%. But that's just one perspective on the border. You know, the other is that, yes, it works in some places, but not in others. I think people on the ground in Texas have a much more nuanced view. And that goes for Republicans as well as Democrats.
Kevin, thanks so much. Appreciate your joining us from Washington with the very latest developments with the president's visit to McAllen, Texas. Thank you.
My pleasure.
From the Houston Chronicle and Hearst Newspapers, Kevin Diaz joining us. Also with us, NPR international correspondent Carrie Kahn. She's based in Mexico City, and she's been reporting out of Reynoso, Mexico, as well as in the McAllen, Texas region after crossing the border. Carrie, good to have you with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So share with us what you've been seeing, your most recent contacts there in McAllen.
I was actually in Reynosa for the last 2 days, just came over the border to come into the U.S. for a quick hit.
Oh, okay. All right. So
I've been out of Reynosa, and it was interesting. I talked to the mayor of Reynosa yesterday. She was really interesting. She said that she doesn't think that the answer to any crisis at the border is a wall. She said the crisis at the border is a humanitarian one, and Reynosa is the city that's suffering from that because of the number of migrants that are stranded there coming from Central America and the number of Mexicans that are deported from the U.S. into her city. Some officials were telling me that's up to 200 a day that come into Reynosa, and Reynosa, unlike McAllen, on the U.S. side of the border here, is one of the most dangerous cities in Mexico. And so the U.S. government is deporting hundreds of Mexicans into the city every day, and they said they're overwhelmed by that situation, and they're overwhelmed by the number of Central Americans that are coming up there too.
Do you have a sense of how many of the Central American refugees are currently being housed there in Reynosa?
A lot of the migrants from Central America are going to Tijuana. That's where they usually go to ask for asylum. I spoke to some Central Americans here that had tried to ask for asylum. It was really interesting. One thing that the Border Patrol had done in agents here in the McAllen-Reynosa areas, they set up a checkpoint. You cross an international walking bridge over to the U.S. side, but in the middle of the bridge, U.S. officials there were stopping migrants wanting to come into the U.S. to ask for asylum and asking them to see their papers and telling them, this is what one man told me, that they were asking them to stop and wait on in the midpoint of the bridge. And then Mexican officials, immigration officials, would come and check their papers. And if they didn't have their papers in order to be in Mexico, they were being apprehended and deported. So that was deterring a lot of people from going to ask for asylum here into the U.S. I don't know how widespread that was, but this is what I heard from officials and from some migrants that had tried to ask for asylum. So there are a lot of Central Americans in Reynosa on the Mexican side. The thousands that we hear about waiting to ask for asylum in the U.S. are more over in Tijuana and the San Diego, California, Baja California region. But a lot of Central Americans have decided to make this area their home, too. They feel like they can't get into the United States. And then you have all these Mexicans that are being deported, too, which is really alarming the officials in Mexico. The mayor was saying she's worried that the crime gangs and the organized gangs that are there operating in the state where she's located prey on these people constantly. It's a terrifying situation for a lot of the migrants and the deported Mexicans. They actually, the state government now keeps them in shelters and doesn't let them go out into the city. And a lot of times people just need to get money so that they can go back to their homes in Mexico or they can go where they need to go. So the state officials actually keep them under police guard, take them to one company only where they can get money out, wire transfers, and then deliver them to the bus station and wait till they get on buses. It's that dangerous for them.
Wow.
That's where the she says we have the humanitarian crisis. The crisis is not in the U.S. side. And as you were just listening from Kevin, you know, these cities along the border and the U.S. are some of the safest cities in the country. That violence isn't spilling over into the United States.
NPR's Carrie Kahn with us describing those difficult circumstances in Reynosa, Mexico, immediately across the border from McAllen, Texas, McAllen, where President Trump is visiting today. Carrie, I just learned about this oil crisis, gasoline crisis in Mexico. I had no idea that so much of the gasoline supply was being siphoned off by criminal gangs, sold at discounted prices, a kind of black market there. Share with us how bad the shortage is right now.
It's getting pretty bad. You know, since I've been here, everybody keeps saying, what are people in Mexico saying about President Trump and his speech from the Oval Office the other night and his visit? People really aren't focused on that at all. It's the gas crisis that they're really concerned about, and it is pretty bad. You know, gas theft, fuel theft in Mexico is like $3 billion a year. Is an incredible amount. And the new president has said that this widespread theft couldn't have taken place without official, you know, complicity from the oil, you know, executives all the way down to those that are running the trucks and the pipelines. And what the problem is that the criminals actually tap into the pipelines, the ducts that are going through the country to deliver the gas. And so what they've done is they've closed a lot of those main gas lines, those pipes, and they are now trucking in the gas to gas stations and distribution depots. And it's just slowed down the distribution of gas all over the country. You know, I'm based in Mexico City, and nobody was really talking about it that much until you know, you'd see pictures in other states, especially in the center of the country. There were states that were something like 83% of the gas stations didn't have gas. But then now all of a sudden it's hitting Mexico City. It's all over the country. Like when I was in Reynosa, the lines were incredible for the gas. It reminded me, you know, this will age me, but it reminded me of the gas crisis in the 70s and those lines we used to sit in. And people were sitting, they were sleeping overnight in their cars so that they would be the first one if the gas station opened. I went to this one gas station where rumors had spread that a gas delivery truck was arriving at 12:30. And the line by like 12 o'clock was already a mile long, and people were waiting 2 hours. If you have a business to run, or you have, you know, even taking your kids to school or whatever you have to do, this is a big inconvenience. It's crazy. And we're hearing from trade organizations that it's affecting production, you know, in major industrial parts of the country. But the president says he's not going to back down. He's going to continue with this plan to cut out the theft. And he said, we'll have to see. He had one famous line. He said, we'll have to see who can hold out longer, us or the thieves.
Wow. And are there even enough tanker trucks in Mexico, do you know, Carrie, to be able to do all this kind of delivery by truck instead of pipeline?
Well, that's a great question, because what the president is not saying is, he keeps saying, we're going to work out the kinks, we're going to work out the kinks. Well, one of the biggest kinks is, do they have enough trucks? And so you just see the media asking around and asking industry leaders if they do. It's a great question, and nobody knows if they do or not, or if they're being put into place to deliver the gas in the strategic areas that they need to do it. The president did announce today that he's going to send troops. I think he said, I forgot the exact number, but to cover 1,600 kilometers, that's about 1,000 miles of the pipeline, and have troops there guarding it. Because even with this increased vigilance that they've had, they saw a major pipeline. They can monitor the levels going through the pipeline, and they saw it drop incredibly quickly. And so they shut off the pipeline. And so it's just a mess, and there's no clear indication of what the government is going to do and how they're going to solve the problem. They just keep saying, we're working the kinks out, it'll be solved soon. I was talking to motorists yesterday. It was interesting, because I don't know, if I had to spend an hour or 2 hours anxiously waiting in line and not knowing if I was going to get gas, I'd be really pissed off. But the people that I talked to said, you know, this is why we elected the president. He said he's going to cut down on corruption, so we need to give him a chance to do it. But I thought that was
It doesn't come pain-free, but it's a lot of pain they're going through. And, you know, the other thing I was thinking about the tanker transportation, that particularly in rural areas of the country, I would bet that those trucks would be susceptible to hijack, because if the criminals can't get the gas out of the pipeline, wouldn't they just take over the trucks from the drivers?
Well, it's a big question, too, because how desperate will these criminal organizations that, you know, enjoyed the theft for decades? This is nothing new. This has gone on for years. And these are powerful criminal gangs. They're not going to take it very lightly that their lifeblood is being taken from them. So, you know, that way they're going to retaliate, and we'll have to see what that looks like. And that's a pretty scary proposition for everybody, from the tanker driver, I think, all the way to the president, who refuses to have bodyguards, which is
really
a big controversy here in Mexico, too.
Carrie, and just before I let you go, is this all controlled by Pemex, Mexico's own government-owned oil company?
Yeah, they control all the...
Everything, okay.
And the president says there's no way this level of theft, for as long as it went on and at the levels that it did, go on, could have happened without the complicity of Pemex officials, and, you know, all the way down to drivers and everything. The amount of fuel theft in the country is just incredible.
Carrie, thank you for updating us on this. I simply had no idea that this was such a huge enterprise in Mexico, and understanding now what kind of a challenge and standoff this is over gasoline supplies. Thank you for talking with us about it.
Sure, I have to fill up my rental car here in McAllen before I drive back over the border and turn it in.
Yeah, definitely. All right, good luck. Thank you. At least there should be plenty of gas in Texas. Carrie Kahn, NPR international correspondent based in Mexico City, joining us from McAllen, Texas, here in the States. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. The birth rate in the United States is down considerably. In fact, under replacement rate. That's what the newest data shows. We'll talk about where in the country those fertility rates are lowest and what the implications are for filling jobs, paying for all the sorts of benefits that older Americans get and the like. That's to come in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Probably no surprise to you that the American birth rate is declining, but the way in which it's declining is quite fascinating. Some substantial differences from state to state. Also on race, ethnicity, and income, big differences there too. And overall, the United States is at below replacement rate, according to demographers. We're going to take a look at some of the numbers nationally and locally. Joining us is Stephen Martin, demographer at the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute based in D.C. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Let's talk first of all about just sort of the larger scale numbers here. My understanding is that just to keep the population at a stable level, you'd have to have 2,100 babies born for every 1,000 women in the country. As of 2017, well below that figure at just over 1,700 births per 1,000 women. Has that trend, has that been a fairly consistent drop over the past decade or so, or has it been more precipitous in recent years?
The fertility rate, by various measures, has been going down across the United States more or less continuously since 2008. In other words, since the beginning of the recession.
All right.
The year-on-year changes are, you know, vary a little bit. And 2017 was a little bit more of a downturn from 16 than has often been the case, although that is just 1 year.
And is it possible that what we're seeing is a lag in births? In other words, American women tend to have children older, and by delaying it, what we're potentially seeing here, particularly with millennials, is just a lag time, and that we're going to see a boom in fertility that makes up for this drop. Is that possible?
That would be a common story, and it's supported by the fact that if you look at the order of births that are occurring, over the last several years, it's been first births that are particularly having lower rates. In other words, there are more women and couples who are delaying the start of a family.
All right. And I want to take a look at ethnicity. We see among white Americans that they have the lowest fertility rate. Latinas are higher. African Americans are higher. Now, here in a very Latino state like California, that's significant for us. The fact that we have a large Latino population, is that helping with our birth rate so that we're not as low as some of the other states that are more white dominant?
Actually, and surprisingly, the opposite is true. Because as fertility has decreased in the last several years, it has been minorities who have had greater decreases in fertility. For example, in the United States, there is very little difference anymore between white, black, and Hispanic fertility. And in California, by 2017, black women are actually having births at slightly lower rates than whites.
Really? Okay. So it's a more precipitous drop there. And do we understand what the reasons for that is? I mean, we know births are sensitive to economics. You mentioned the economic downturn and when we saw the decline there. Do we understand how that's expressed with family income on the individual basis?
okay, I can't go directly into income because we don't get a lot of that in birth data, but I can tell you that the groups that are having the greatest decreases in fertility are minorities in California and elsewhere, are young women. Teen births are declining, but so are 20-something births. And then lastly, intended births tend to be occurring at close to the same rates as before, but unintended births are really going down. One way to think of this is that the economy can be contributing, but also improvements in the use of contraception for people who don't want to have children. That appears to be going on. So if you want to encapsulate the story, since the start of the recession, we have more and more people who are waiting to have births that they still intend to have.
All right. But it's unclear whether they actually will have those births because there may be intervening factors. It is more difficult to get pregnant later in life and if there's not access to fertility aids and the like. So I guess we don't necessarily know if all those intended births will actually take place in the years to come.
Yes, we do have a previous example of something like this demographic pattern occurring. In the 1970s, generally highly educated white women really had a decrease in teen and 20-something birth rates. As it turns out, by the 1980s and 90s, there was an increase in 30-something birth rates that didn't completely but largely offset the previous decreases.
All right. Stephen Martin, demographer at the Center on Labor, Human Services and Population at the D.C.-based Urban Institute, also with us from the American Public Health Association, Executive Director Georges C. Benjamin. Dr. Benjamin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Glad to be here.
What are the potential effects of this? And let's say that it isn't just a lag time, but that the U.S. isn't going to be at replacement rates of population. What are the implications of that, particularly with the aging baby boom cohort?
Well, you know, as we're all getting older, we're always wondering who's going to take care of us. So issues around the workforce are a big one. Paying into the Social Security fund is another. Those are significant economic and societal issues that people are very much concerned about.
Yeah, and obviously immigration could backstop some of this, but you need a match in immigrants coming into the country, presumably with the jobs that would be open for them and in demand. So that would be a challenge to match that up too.
Yeah, they still could have an impact on the population size for sure, help very much on the workforce, and they certainly do pay taxes, and when they're working, also bringing in Social Security. But having said that, it doesn't change the fertility rate very much because they also, frankly, like the rest of us who are native-born, make some of the same decisions, same choices, reproductive choices that really don't change the fertility rate very much.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Georges C. Benjamin of the American Public Health Association. One of the things that we see in surveys of young people is they're having less sex. And could that be one of the factors that we're seeing, particularly when it comes to unintended pregnancies, and that number is going to stay low as long as younger people are actually having less intercourse than in the past?
Well, I think one of the public health successes is that we have certainly seen a big drop in teenage pregnancies. A lot of that's education. That's a good public health win. Hopefully those children, when they get into relationships in which they do choose to have children and are able to take care of those children, will indeed, as you, the earlier speaker, you know, Stephen talked about, begin to, you know, build families and have children. California is having a challenge. You know, you folks have a rate of about 1,692, and you're supposed to, you know, to maintain that society is supposed to be 2,100. So California has a ways to go in order to try to turn that around as a state. But, of course, you know, people move between states. So looking at those numbers, just it's an interesting number state by state. But as we think about this, we really need to make broader societal change if we're going to turn this around and try to fix it.
Yeah, and as you say, Americans are highly mobile, so that does factor into this, where there'll be jobs, where there'll be economic need in the future. Dr. Benjamin, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
From the American Public Health Association, and Stephen Martin from the Urban Institute Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population. Thank you as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Eddie Lynn Hurdy's with a news update, including a new development in that labor impasse between the LA Unified School District and its teachers. I'll be back with a look at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas and some of the more interesting devices that are being debuted there. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. What we want to check in is the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas is winding down. To find out some of the highlights there. We can't even begin to cover all the gadgets that debut. We're talking about thousands of things. Yesterday, in fact, we talked about the meatless hamburger that was debuting as a part of CES. With us to talk about the top tech is Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief of CNET, and Jeremy Kaplan, the editor-in-chief of Digital Trends. Good to have you both with us. Let me start, first of all, with something I could sure use. The Foldamate laundry folding machine. As the one who does the laundry in our household, I would love to have this. Lindsay, what can you tell us about this device?
Oh, gosh. Well, this thing is large. It's not small, so you can start with a large laundry room. It's probably about, I don't know, Jeremy, you probably saw it, 4 feet wide, probably about 4.5 feet tall. It costs $1,000, but it neatly takes everything you want to feed into it. Every item of clothing, you kind of stand there, clip an item in, sucks it into the machine, fold it, spits it out in a nice rectangle. I really think this is, as much as I would love to have it, I probably wouldn't want to stand there and feed items in one at a time. It's really going to be great at, like, the Gap in the back room.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of a clothes processor to compare it to a kitchen device. And yeah, it sounds like too big, too expensive for me. But it does. It's sort of a fun idea. Kohler is coming out with a smart toilet, Jeremy. Now, it's even going to have compatibility with Alexa. Gee, what could go wrong with that?
Yeah, it sounds a little funny. But, you know, at CES, we see the breadth of products that are touched by technology in our lives today, and that extends to things like toilets. So we have companies like Kohler that come out here and showcase smart devices that are internet enabled and have Alexa. One of the things that's neat about this is it can sense your presence, and as you walk up to it, the toilet seat will lift up to prepare for your arrival. The Alexa sounds like a weird thing, but I think it has a lot of features that maybe one doesn't think about, and your mind races to some silly uses for it, but it can also set the mood for you and play some music or change the lighting or whatnot. And if you're a parent wrestling to get some pants on some kid in the morning, it's easy to think about ways that you can use that to, you know, check the weather or check on the news while you're, you know, fussing with other things. So it's easy to think about things like smart toilets and think about the silly side. There are also some practical uses for these things.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. And it resolves any dispute over the seat up or down issue. Somewhat related to it, there's a smart diaper sensor that was showcased that has a Bluetooth sensor to determine when the baby has gone number one or number two. Jeremy, that's I could actually see some utility for parents.
What's nice is the way that you see at CES, people coming up with ideas for practical problems. And yes, it's silly. Like, is it pee? Is it poop? But, you know, if you're a parent, that's a very real situation. Do I need to rush to the bathroom right now? Do I need to drop everything and go solve this problem? Or can I wait an extra 13, 14 minutes? Then it's nice to see that there's ways that technology can solve some of the little problems for us in life.
So parents get alerted when the diaper needs to be changed. We're talking about the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas with Lindsay Turrentine of CNET, Jeremy Kaplan of Digital Trends. If you've heard about any of the CNET tech that you wanted to ask about, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lindsay, are there any kitchen devices that particularly stood out to you?
There's been a lot this year because there's so much of an emphasis on smart home. I was over in the KitchenAid booth yesterday, and they had some really interesting integration for ovens. They had taken inspiration from, you know, on a KitchenAid mixer, there's the part that you plug attachments into at the top. They essentially created something like that that goes in the oven so that there's a special element and grill pan that's all self-contained inside the oven. You can actually put new attachments in the oven so that you can grill in your oven and do lots of different types of cooking with the oven. There are sensors built into the pan, and the oven itself is a smart oven that feeds recipes to you step at a time so you know exactly what to do in your oven. So there's a lot of innovative thinking happening about how we can use new types of sensors and new types of materials that include protective coatings to do interesting things inside the kitchen.
Lindsay, is this more of a focus of CES than in the past? I mean, I remember smart refrigerators and things like that, but I don't remember as much, it seems, of this kind of actual cooking devices.
This has been a growing category over, I'd say, probably about the last 3 years. I think about 4 years ago, smart home started to become a really big topic at CES, and that sort of smart home idea started with things like refrigerators, you're right, and then we got some really interesting washers and dryers, and now a lot of traditional manufacturers are thinking about ways in which they can use all the technology that's been developed over the last few years to assist in a better experience throughout the house. Sometimes these devices are really very kind of pie in the sky or are aimed directly at high-end customers, but what we see is that over time, the best features, the standout features, the ones that really do make an impact for people, trickle down into devices that we will buy sort of in a normal kitchen remodel.
Do you think, Lindsay, that some of these debuts are an effort to kind of float a product and to see what the social media and public response is? Is it strategic in that way?
Oh, for sure, especially for small companies who bring their Kickstarter projects. And even some large companies are starting to roll out items based on Kickstarter projects or Indiegogo kind of projects, and they will see what takes and what really attracts people. So, for instance, Procter & Gamble has a device at the show this year that is it's essentially a printer for your face. So you run this wand over your face. It can tell whether you have a mole or a freckle or a blemish, and it actually paints makeup on that little spot only where it's needed. And wow, this thing has gotten so much attention. That's a good example of trying something new and seeing where it goes at the show.
Wow. Lindsay Turrentine of CNET, Jeremy Kaplan of Digital Trends. Jeremy, I was seeing that one of the debuts was a bread vending machine that actually bakes the bread in the machine before it serves it to you. And it would seem if you're going to go that far, I mean, you could end up with all kinds of cooking and baking vending machines.
Oh, yeah. And there's a slew of things like that. One of the things that I thought was a standout was an announcement from LG about a home brewing system. It uses little pods, and you can monitor the evolution of your IPA or lager or whatever you happen to be brewing on a smartphone app. And it takes, you know, it's going to take you 2 weeks or 3 weeks to brew a batch of beer. But making that process simple, I think it's just a fantastic idea. As Lindsay was saying, there's just a wealth of changes that are coming into the kitchen. And it's really interesting to see it happen at CES. And it's, you see companies wrestling with, is this a practical idea? Or is this just staking a flag in the sand to say we're at the cutting edge? You were asking earlier, Larry, are these all products that are going to actually come out? That's a really great question, because I think even with some of the bigger manufacturers, sometimes you see products that are an idea, a concept that maybe isn't going to be so practical and maybe isn't going to get picked up by some of the big retailers. But we're always excited to talk about them in any way.
Yeah.
It's a vision of the future. That's really what you see at CES more than anything else.
Coming up, we'll talk about what we think of as the more conventional CES topics and products, 5G and what's going on with 5G with its whole home applications and with wireless transmission generally. We'll also be talking about televisions of all things. They're our new developments there. We'll talk about LG's new television that's getting quite a bit of buzz as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Joining us from Las Vegas's Consumer Electronics Show, Digital Trends Editor-in-Chief Jeremy Kaplan, CNET.com's Editor-in-Chief Lindsay Turrentine. We'll continue in just 1 minute. Coming up in our second hour on Air Talk, new California Governor Gavin Newsom introducing his proposed budget for next year. We'll talk about some of the new initiatives that are included in it, talk about the fiscal challenges presented, and we'll debate whether they'd be a benefit to most Californians. That's coming up in our second hour of Air Talk. Right now, we're talking about whether the products at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas would benefit the typical household. With us is CNET Editor-in-Chief Lindsay Turrentine and from Digital Trends Editor-in-Chief Jeremy Kaplan. Lindsay, I want to ask you about 5G because we hear all the promise of its ability to instantaneously interconnect all kinds of different devices. What are we seeing in the way of breakthroughs with 5G?
I think this is, it's a little early to see any breakthroughs with 5G, to be perfectly honest. What we're hearing a lot about is what is going to be available next year. Most of the major carriers have some degree of 5G available now in very small pockets in very small places. And just to remind people what 5G is, this is the next iteration of the cell network that is going to be faster, of course. This is going to really bring down latency. So the idea of 5G is that we're all going to be able to communicate much more quickly and upload much more quickly so that we can do things like in the dream. We were talking the other day in a panel about being able to play with your band on the other side of the world live. So one drummer is playing and one guitarist is playing and the latency is so low that that music sounds like it's happening instantaneously, which is impossible today. But there, what we're talking about at the show is still very much here's what it's going to be like, not necessarily here's what it is. We have gotten announcements of, there was a router announced earlier this week that should be able to, once 5G is available on all the major networks and the carriers can make it available to you in your town, to let you take the 5G signal out of the air and then turn it into Wi-Fi in your home so that you don't have to run a cable to your house. That's one of the more interesting things that you're going to be able to do with 5G. That router came from D-Link.
And Verizon, you were mentioning earlier, some of the carriers do offer this in select markets. Verizon, one of those here in Southern California, that in select markets is offering this.
It is available in select markets. They're very small markets. I believe Sacramento is one of them. Los Angeles, there is some available. There are some households doing it. It's very narrow right now. We expect that next year, in the coming year, and then 2020 is when this is really going to start to become available to people at a mass level.
Jeremy Kaplan, one of the things I've heard said is that, well, it's what Verizon and some of the other carriers are offering isn't really true 5G yet. Can you provide the distinction what we're talking about here?
Yeah, for sure. That's a really interesting point because Verizon's getting a lot of heat. And rightly so over this tactic. The point that Verizon is trying to make is most people that have cell phones today have 4G-based cell phones. And if you look in the top right corner of the screen on your smartphone, you'll probably see a little 4G icon or an LTE icon. So LTE stands for long-term evolution because the point has always been with 4G that it was going to get faster as it evolved. And so what AT&T is trying to stress here is that some of the 4G networks in various places around the country are fast enough that they're closing in on the speed of 5G. So they're calling it 5GE. This is unfortunate, however, because the reality is it's not 5G. And at the same time, they're calling some things 5GE. They're also building a 5G network. I think it's just going to lead to a lot of consumer confusion. Do I have a 5G phone? Does it do all this neat stuff that you're talking about? Or is this just a branding effort? And it really feels like a branding effort from Verizon, which is just unfortunate, really.
Jeremy, let's talk about televisions, because it's been a while since we've had much big news made with TVs. But this year at CES, there is an interesting development from LG.
Yeah, LG has this roll-up television, which is really a phenomenal concept. It's the OLED screen. So that's OLED technology is the one that has the deepest, richest blacks, the most vibrant colors. We've been awarding it. I'm sure that CNET has as well. We've been calling it some of the best televisions you can buy. That's, of course, a flat panel that sits on your wall. And if you have a 70-inch or an 80-inch flat panel sitting on your wall, oftentimes it's just often is a dark black square on your wall. Nobody wants that. So LG has developed a technology that allows this thing to roll down into the sound bar that sits on top of your desktop. In other words, when the screen is off, you can make it vanish completely, which is just a really beautiful design concept. Now, they haven't announced how much this thing is going to cost, and you have to imagine that it's the sort of product that appeals to people that can also afford yachts. It's not going to be cheap, but it is a really beautiful concept.
Well, and Lindsay, then the question is, I mean, yeah, maybe for very wealthy people now, but is it something that can be mass-produced at lower cost in the years to come, and is everybody going to end up with a roll-up TV?
I don't know that everybody's going to end up with a roll-up TV, but I do think the cost will come down. And CES has historically always been about television. This has been the show where big, beautiful televisions get announced. People ooh and ah at them. And then 2 or 3 years down the road can actually afford to make an investment in those televisions. So like Jeremy said, this television, it's using the LG OLED technology, which is already pretty much the best on the market. And that's widely available. A lot of people buy those TVs. Now the difference here is the bendability of those screens. Rolling screens, bending screens are something that the display industry has been working really hard on because they think that this is the future and this is what's going to cause people to buy and upgrade the TVs that they already have. Right now, there's not a lot of reason to upgrade the television that you have. And this may be a reason. So the manufacturers are going to be very invested in bringing that cost down over time. And it really is a beautiful and fascinating product.
What about virtual reality? Any breakthroughs, Lindsay, in VR?
I think that the biggest breakthroughs in VR are going to come with 5G, which we were talking about earlier. VR is a little bit at a standstill right now. Not a lot changing in that market. And I think that interest has leveled out a little bit since the first concepts came out. But I think that next year at CES, I'm looking forward to seeing some really interesting advancements because I think that the ability to communicate with other people who are also wearing VR headsets is going to change the experience with VR.
Jeremy, I'm getting a little short on time, but I wanted to ask you quickly about robots. Any fun or particularly useful robots you saw debuting?
Robots are an interesting category at CES and one that we all love talking about because why wouldn't you? They're robots. Samsung has a really interesting demonstration of some of their own robotic technology. One of the things, so there's, of course, a personal assistant robot. There's a robot for the elderly. One of the things that I thought was particularly neat was an exoskeleton that's going to enhance the it's a wearable skeleton that you put over your legs to, and this isn't designed to be to enable superhuman powers in anyone. It's really for somebody who has mobility issues. One of the things that I love about technology is the ways that it can actually solve real-world problems for us. You know,
yeah. You
know, technology that helps parents that are, you know, struggled with time or dealing with children. Here's the thing that can help someone that's, if not crippled, at least has mobility issues of their own. And it's nice to see when technology can really bring that. That's people.
Yeah, and when the technology is affordable for people with disabilities to be able to use it to improve their lives. Jeremy and Lindsay, thanks so much. It's Air Talk on KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, Your Survival Guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Let's go to Sacramento and join in progress. Governor Gavin Newsom as he introduces his proposed budget.
I'm just giving you a sense of where we're starting. And I think it's an important message because the message we are advancing here is discipline, building a strong foundation to which everything else can be built. We are projecting this year, not projecting, we're arguing for a 15.3% rainy day reserve. And I say arguing for that, and I'll get to why I am not statutorily required to do that, but I'm arguing that based upon some legal counsel opinions. But that is an increase from the $13.5 billion you saw before. And in our forecast period, again, I'm presenting a one-year budget today with three-year forecast. Over the forecast period, we are anticipating getting to $19.4 billion in what is commonly referred to as the rainy day reserve. We are assuming that we are going to continue economic expansion. I know that sends shivers up some people's spine because we're almost 10 years into that recovery. And I watched those last few budget presentations by Governor Brown. Every year he started with that. Let me get that out of the way. None of us are naive. Like the governor said, the next governor is going to be standing on the cliff, right? That may be true. This may be that moment. So we are cognizant of that, and I'm going to explain how we're going to represent that more fully in the budget. As a consequence of that trepidation and anxiety, we're not projecting what has traditionally been an average growth rate of about 5%. When you look back at previous budgets that have been submitted, we're anticipating a 3.2% growth rate over the next few years in personal income tax, the sales, and the corporate tax. So we're moderating our projections based upon the legitimate anxiety that we are overdue for a correction. And substantively, that moderation comes in this form. Because of the progressivity of our tax code, we're anticipating some good news that interestingly has a negative impact on our revenue, and that is we're going to start seeing some middle income wage increases. But because the middle income tax brackets lack the progressivity of the higher income tax brackets, it will actually generate less revenue for the state. So it's perverse in some sense. Good for the individual, good for the people of the state, not necessarily good for the budget. So modest, but nonetheless growth.
Listening to just some of the premises of the proposed budget that Governor Gavin Newsom is releasing today, it looks like he's going to go in depth with not just projected revenues, how much of a reserve he wants, as we just heard, a reserve of 15% of the budget, which would grow the $13.5 billion reserve as it currently exists, projected on just over 3% annual growth over the next few years. And then he'll be talking about specific areas that are growth areas in his budget because of priorities that the governor laid out both in his inaugural address on Monday as well as in repeated comments that he made during the course of his campaign. One of the areas that the governor has said is a priority is early childhood education, where he wants to put additional dollars into public preschool. With us is KPCC senior early childhood reporter Priska Neely. Priska, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
So how much are we talking about the governor's hoping to get for public preschool for California kids?
So the proposal is almost $2 billion, and that would go into a range of programs for children 0 to 5. So some of that would be subsidized childcare. We know a little bit about possible training for providers and also money for facilities improvements. But also some of this is going into kindergarten. And actually, a lot of school districts still offer only half-day kindergarten programs. And so there would be an effort to extend those two full-day programs that can help working parents. But there's also a plan to roll out over 3 years a universal preschool program for four-year-olds from low-income families. So those are just some of the things that we know. And, of course, we'll be getting more details throughout the day today.
Now, there was, I guess over a decade ago now, Rob Reiner, mm-hmm. the director and actor, had put on the ballot a universal preschool measure, which was defeated right. by voters. Is that what Newsom eventually wants to get to?
You know, it's not clear how that would be funded. In 2006, that was a tax that would be on individuals making over $400,000. And that was defeated, as you said, at the time. But it's, you know, it's not clear exactly where the money would come from for this plan. It would be the plan so far would be to have $125 million in the first year and have it be a slow rollout once we get to universal preschool. But this is something the legislature also has been working toward, too. And Kevin McCarthy has a proposal also working toward preschool for low-income four-year-olds. So, you know, there's a lot that still has to be worked out here.
We just received the actual summary of the governor's proposed budget. It includes $500 million of one-time general fund expenditures to build child care infrastructure, including investing in the education, the child care workforce that Priska was just describing. The intent would be to reduce health disparities in early childhood, and additional funding would come to improve the detection of adverse childhood experiences, is written, increased developmental screenings provided to children through the Medi-Cal program. It would also include funding to expand existing home visiting programs, providing innovative new approaches. That's what's touted in the summary here, to reach low-income young mothers, and it would augment the Black Infant Health Program. The budget also including funding to raise grants for the lowest income families served by the CalWORKS program to 50% of the federal poverty level. And the budget would also propose supplemental Cal grants of up to $6,000 for student parents who have dependent children. Those would be parents who are going to California public colleges, and it would increase the number of competitive Cal Grant awards to help make higher education more affordable for lower income Californians. So that's just a few of the items that are included here as priorities in this summary of Governor Gavin Newsom's budget. KPCC senior early childhood reporter Priska Neely talking with us about some of the plan. Now, with the one-time expenditures that would be made here, Priska, do you know how the funding would continue for that, what the plan would be?
No, and that's actually some people that I've talked to in the field have that concern. You know, we've seen investments like this that have gone in and then kind of gone away when there's been, you know, as you just heard the governor say, no one's naive here. We don't know what's going to happen with the economy. But a lot of people in the field are hoping to see more long-term investments that are really made that would be sustained over time, because it's not clear. But as you can see in that list you just read there, you know, early childhood sounds specific when you talk about investments in just the 0 to 5 space, but we're talking about millions of children, 650,000 in LA County alone, that would be affected under, you know, between 0 and 5. And there are a lot of questions of whether you prioritize early childhood, the 0 to 3 programs, the home visiting, or whether you focus on universal preschool and so many other things, workforce, parenting, you know, so many things.
Priska Neely, KPCC early childhood reporter, also with us from First 5 LA, the child advocacy organization, Kim Patillo Brownson. Thank you so much for being with us, Kim. We appreciate it. What are your thoughts about what the governor is proposing here?
There is an incredible amount of enthusiasm and really gratitude for the governor's new proposal. It is absolutely a new day in terms of gubernatorial leadership, in terms of making young children a top priority. And I think what's also quite noticeable about the package that he's introduced is it recognizes this idea that children don't live in silos. Children don't come to us in pieces, and that what he is actually proposing is a comprehensive approach, which recognizes that in order to thrive, young children need education, they need health, and they need family supports as well. The other thing that I think is also very noteworthy is just the size and scope of this investment. It is a high water mark in terms of governors across the nation, in terms of actually providing a robust package that is not just about sort of the value of young children, but actually investing in young children and their development in ways that suggest that he is very serious, and that this is going to be a robust conversation for the budget and an opportunity to invest in our kids.
We're talking with Kim Petillo-Brownson, who is Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Child Advocacy Group First 5 LA. Also with us, Legislative Director for the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, David Wolf. David, it's good to have you with us again. Your concerns about the amount of money designated here.
Yeah, Lori, hi. It's good to be back on the air with you and your listeners. And, you know, I have 3 points, and I can either run through those now or we can kind of break it up in segments.
Yeah, why don't you hit them in quick summary form, then we can come back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just say really quickly, I mean, should government be expanded yet again to fund yet another expensive mandate that doesn't have a proven track record? And I think the answer is no. I mean, the program that we're talking about here, Universal Preschool, is an expensive $1.8 billion mandate without that track record. And Assemblyman McCarthy, the author of the proposal, he points to a program in Chicago, you know, to make the point that this works. But the issue with that is that program had extensive requirements for parental training that the California program doesn't have. And the Brookings Institute has done all sorts of studies with Head Start that show on a longitudinal basis that these programs just don't work. So.
Okay. So you think expensive mandate and the evidence isn't there. What's your second concern about it?
Well, I mean, that sort of was the second point.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there's been a Brookings Institute study that shows, looking at two programs, one a voluntary program in Tennessee and the other one with Head Start, that, you know, students that are engaged in these type of universal preschool programs, the academic gains just don't last. In fact, within 3 years, kids who don't participate in the program were doing better than those who did. And I think the key, again, if this is going to work at all on any sort of level, is parental involvement. And, you know, I'm not convinced that the state can mandate that on a universal level. In individual track programs,
all right,
among individual communities, maybe. But, I mean, I think it's highly questionable. And you're talking about a big investment, you know, getting to the third point. And is that money better spent on prioritization of other things? Are there better uses of taxpayer dollars?
We're talking with Dave. Let me just break in there. David Wolf, Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Let me go back to our reporter, Priska Neely. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you is what for the specific pre-K or public preschool, would this require that those teachers be credentialed who are teaching in those programs?
Ooh, that is a complicated question because there's such a wide range of requirements for early childhood educators, and because of the really complicated system of funding, different programs have different requirements. A lot of programs, Head Start, which is a federal program, is working towards having bachelor's degrees for teachers. Right now, it's really a wide variety in terms of whether teachers have bachelor's degrees, associate's degrees, or are kind of working towards those degrees as they're, you know, going to community college while getting their teaching hours. But there's a really wide range of what aides are required to have versus lead teachers. And that's something that's actually being worked out now with the credentialing system in California.
Let me bring into the conversation from UC Berkeley, Professor of Education and Public Policy, Bruce Fuller. Professor, thank you for joining us. Just your quick reaction to the governor's proposal here.
Thanks, Larry. Well, first of all, I wanted to ditto what Kim Petillo-Brownson said. I think in the academic world, there's huge enthusiasm in part because the governor has shown a firm grasp of the evidence. I think David Wolf is cherry-picking studies. We have about a half century of a series of studies which show pretty strong boosts for kids from low-income families who go through quality pre-K. I think David's right that we have some low-quality programs that are not effective, but in four California counties, we've had pretty rigorous studies now which show a big bump for kids from low- and middle-income households. And I guess my second opening point, Larry, is just a friendly amendment to Priska's overview. The biggest item in the governor's proposal this week is a $2.5 billion increase in paid family leave. And in a sense, this should please conservatives, because this is really saying that families are the first teachers of all kids. And the governor's proposing to expand paid family leave from about 6 to 8 weeks on average to 26 weeks. It's going to be costly. He would probably have to adjust the payroll tax, perhaps on wealthy individuals. But this governor is taking a two-pronged approach of trying to nurture and foster stronger families who are raising newborns, as well as build up organizations and centers that provide high-quality pre-K.
We'll continue our conversation. That's UC Berkeley Professor Bruce Fuller, David Wolf of the Jarvis Taxpayers Association, Kim Patillo-Brownson of First 5 LA, and we have yet another guest I'll be introducing. And with us throughout the course of the hour, Priska Neely, KPCC Senior Early Childhood Reporter. I just realized, and I should have disclosed this at the beginning, that my wife works in a public preschool. So just to make that personal reference, I didn't think to mention it, but that's probably important for me to disclaim. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'll be back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Right now in Sacramento, Governor Newsom unveiling his proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year. Let me just hit some of the major points that are here. And of course, the legislature is going to have its say. Once revenues are more nailed down, the governor comes back with a May budget revision. All that ahead of the legislature ultimately passing and the governor signing a new budget prior to the start of the 2019-2020 fiscal year. So the budget includes $4 billion to eliminate budgetary deficits and reverse past deferrals. There's nearly $2.5 billion to pay off budgetary debts. Elimination of all outstanding loans from transportation accounts. You remember the gas tax where they had taken money out of that in special funds. There's $1 billion to eliminate annual payroll deferrals and $700 million to eliminate a deferred payment to CalPERS, the state public employee retirement system. It also calls for building additional reserves beyond the $13.5 billion currently in the rainy day fund. It assumes additional transfers, nearly $2 billion during the upcoming budget year, and an additional $4 billion when you count the several years out in the forecasted period here. $700 million would go to a safety net reserve that would be created as well. So Gavin Newsom is looking at increasing the size of the reserve. That is definitely going to make some fiscal conservatives happy. But, you know, undergirding all of this debate over the budget is the volatility of tax collections here in California. It is such a progressive state income tax based on how well the finances of the state's wealthiest people do that volatility is a potential cause for concern. The state revenues are great right now, but if the economy slows down, that's a concern about collections going forward. Now, back to our debate over Gavin Newsom's priority in this budget for funding preschool, parental training, and other things is the Cato Institute's director of the Center for Educational Freedom, Neil McCluskey. Cato is a libertarian-minded think tank in D.C. Neil, thank you for being with us again. Your concerns about putting public dollars into preschool or in efforts at universal public preschool?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I guess I'm sort of going to be maybe splitting the difference between David's concerns and Bruce's, at least about what the research tells us about pre-K education. And I think the main takeaway is that the research really isn't conclusive. It's not that we know pre-K doesn't work, that public investments in pre-K doesn't work, but it doesn't actually support a decisive conclusion that it's a good use of money. There's certainly research that suggests it. Much of that is not the highest quality random assignment research, which is actually pretty hard to do. And I think that it kind of breaks down this way. I mean, the random assignment research has looked pretty, or several times, at kind of shorter-term outcomes for pre-K. So if somebody goes to pre-K, how do they do versus someone who didn't get it and they're randomly assigned, which controls for all sorts of confounding variables? And what it finds is the child who finishes pre-K does typically do better in kindergarten, but those benefits fade out by the time they're in third grade. There is longer-term evidence about sort of long-term life outcomes beyond just test scores. That's random assignment that James Heckman, the economist, has done much of this, that says there may be very powerful long-term effects, but the problem is the vast majority of that research is based on some very small, extremely intensive programs that occurred in the late 60s, early 1970s that are really hard to extrapolate to large statewide programs in the modern day. So I think it's certainly we shouldn't say that pre-K doesn't work, but I think we have to be cautious in saying that we know it does.
What about the issue of sort of parent selection in the process here? Because I know this has been an issue with magnet schools, for example, public magnets, where you get a self-selecting group of students because the most involved parents are the ones who work the hardest to get their kids into the magnet programs, and that may be a confounding element in researching how those particular schools work. Is sort of parent initiative to get their kids into public early childhood ed, is that a confounding aspect of the research here, or can they control for that?
Yeah, that's always one of the biggest concerns, because when you do statistical controls, usually you're controlling for something you can see, income, race, something like that. And motivation is hard to capture. The random assignment captures that. And it's important to note there are a lot of non-random assignment studies that try to do that statistically. You can do it with things called regression discontinuity design and things like that that can tell us something, but we can't be as certain that those sort of unobservable variables aren't causing the outcomes we're looking at. We can't be as sure as we can be when we used random assignments. So again, the point isn't to say that this isn't something that should be tried, but we should be very cautious in saying we know that this is a good investment. We should certainly be cautious when somebody says, well, for every dollar we spend, we get $3 or $4 or $7 back from that investment.
Bruce Fuller, UC Berkeley education professor, you want to respond to Neil's point?
Well, maybe, Larry, I shouldn't continue the research seminar discussion. I do agree with the point being made that the effects of pre-K are stronger when we have higher quality. And as the governor's proposal goes into the legislature, there will be a debate around to what extent do we put new dollars into more slots to serve more families. Only about 48% of all parents in California with a 3 or 4 year old can even find an affordable slot. So there's enormous legislative pressure to create slots. On the other hand, I do agree with what David is saying, which is if we don't have sufficient quality, we're going to have lower levels of benefit. So there's nothing in the governor's proposal that we've seen yet to, for example, raise the grants that go out to community-based preschools or preschools at LA Unified. And unless those rates are raised, we can't raise teacher salaries and the salaries of classroom aides. If we can't attract stronger teaching staff, we're going to see weaker benefits from pre-K. So that's going to be a point of debate in the legislature. Do we expand slots to serve more families, or do we ramp up the quality to ensure stronger benefits?
All right. Bruce Fuller of UC Berkeley, professor of education and public policy. Back to our KPCC senior early childhood reporter, Prisca Neely. Prisca, the funds aren't just going to pre-K or to preschool. There's also money here for child care at even earlier years.
Right. I mean, I think that's what's really interesting about this conversation is that, you know, just this focus on early childhood. You know, you're looking at the budget summary and there's a whole section on early childhood. That is different. That's different to come up in the January budget. And a couple of years ago, there was a conversation about actually slashing seats for subsidized childcare. So it's a really different moment right now in just having a governor who is really focused on the early years, but is also, as Kim mentioned, you know, viewing this in a holistic way and looking at how parents are involved, how families are involved, how childcare is linked to the ability of parents to work. And, you know, just everything that is that we know about what's happening in the brain in the early years, when we look at quality, it's not just about a traditional school environment. It's just about the experiences that children have, the interactions that they have with caregivers or parents in those early years, and trying to improve quality in all of those scenarios, whether it's childcare or preschool or just the ability of a parent to, you know, to bond in the beginning.
Kim Petillo-Brownson of First 5 LA, I was wondering about the ability to hire enough teachers or childcare workers to provide the education or care that we're talking about. Is this going to require a massive recruiting effort?
You know, that is a issue that both the early learning sector as well as the K-12 sector is facing across the state. The Learning Policy Institute up in Northern Cal at Stanford has done extensive work on looking at the graying of the teacher workforce, both in early learning as well as K-12. But I think what we're seeing in this budget is actually much more a focus on the existing workforce and ensuring that they have access to the training that will actually make them effective and deliver the gains that we've seen from these studies that have really multiplied in years past. I believe Neil mentioned the University of Chicago and the Heckman studies, and you know he's a Nobel laureate on this, so it is not flimsy research. It is robust, and the workforce training piece of it, I think, figures quite prominently into the budget package that Governor Newsom has proposed. This is also a signaling of a new day and a new moment where workforce development and training and ensuring that we have effective programs is really front and center in this argument.
Kim, if you had control over where these dollars were going to be spent, what would be your priorities for where they go?
I think there is already a right-headed orientation, which is to recognize the whole child, which is to actually bring together these elements of health and education and family strengthening. And to your point earlier about family initiative, another, you know, to paraphrase family initiative, what that really is about is parental agency and a sense of efficacy, which middle-class parents across the state have a sense of entitlement, I think, and a positive entitlement, that their children should be able to thrive. And I think a lot of the parent efficacy that the governor's budget is actually talking about building is to actually inculcate the sense of agency among parents to ensure that they are advocates for their children, that they connect them with the resources that they need, that they take advantage of home visiting, that they make sure that they take their children to well baby screenings and get developmental screenings early, and connect them to the services that, again, as middle-class parents, most of us take for granted that we would be able to flag and get services. But for a lot of low-income families, and especially for low-income families in Los Angeles County, where we know we have a disproportionate number of those children, that is just not the reality right now. Right. And I think this is a roadmap to get there.
Kim Petillo-Brownson joining us from First 5 LA. We'll continue our conversation. I'd really like to hear your input as an AirTalk listener. Do you support Governor Newsom's spending on early childhood experiences, whether it's child care, whether we're talking about public preschool or pre-K expansion? What do you think about that? Should that be a budgetary priority, as Governor Newsom says he's going to make that as a part of his administration? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. Times are good in California economically, and that's reflected in Governor Gavin Newsom's proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year. It's up 4% from the current year's budget, $144 billion. In general fund spending, it includes more than $13.5 billion to build up state reserves and to pay down state debt. Also has $2.5 billion going into early childhood education and health care. He's asking lawmakers to expand the state's paid leave program for new parents to 6 months paid leave, and also calling for additional spending that would go toward higher education in California and a number of other initiatives that we will be getting to. Nearly $2 billion would support low-income children for construction of child care facilities and kindergarten classrooms, and it would allow for lower-income California kids to have universal public preschool. With us, KPCC Senior Early Childhood Reporter Priska Neely. We have also a panel of other guests on this topic of early childhood education, and we welcome your calls at 866-893-KPCC. Roger in Lincoln Heights, you're on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. I'm the founder of a charter school in Lincoln Heights. We're kindergarten through 12th grade, and I could just tell you anecdotally that I could point out which kindergartners have had preschool and which haven't. The behaviors are so dramatically different. I know this is anecdotal and it's not much of a study, but it's pretty clear that the investment in preschool is so critical. But one point I wanted to make is that we're a dual language immersion Spanish and English school, and we know that from age 3 to age 8 you can learn 2, 3, 4, 5 languages and speak them perfectly without accent. After age 8 it gets more difficult. If I had preschool to start our dual language program, our kids will become bilingual so much more quickly and more effectively. And we know from data that bilingual kids are smarter. It's just that simple. There's no question about it.
Roger, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Priska Neely, do you know if there is much of a movement toward multiple language immersion programs in preschool?
Well, it's definitely a big part of the conversation, especially when you look at the workforce and making sure that teachers are equipped to deal with, you know, children who speak different languages at home and to really maximize on the potential in those early years.
And that's a challenge even in K through 12,
absolutely,
let alone preschool.
Yeah, and it's going on a lot in transitional kindergarten as well. You know, part of the school districts for four-year-olds having dual language immersion programs at the TK level.
Neil McCluskey of the Cato Institute, you know, I think Roger speaks for a lot of our listeners who just, they intuitively feel like, and they see that kids that go to preschool have a big advantage. And, you know, how did you respond to that? Just sort of what seems to so many people self-evident, even without studies?
Well, what Roger pointed out is something that the research regularly finds, which is that the kids who've had preschool do better in kindergarten. The problem is those advantages don't last. And for instance, we talked about, I think David mentioned the Tennessee random assignment program for a study of a big program in Tennessee, which had 9 of the 10 sort of top quality indicators you wanted. And it found, yes, there was clearly better performance in kindergarten, but by the time you got to third grade, though, not only were the kids who got pre-K doing no better, in some cases they were doing worse. And so the problem is fade out, not what we get immediately after pre-K.
All right. Let me go back to Bruce Fuller, UC Berkeley Professor of Education and Public Policy. Is dual or multiple language immersion something you think is there research indicating the benefit of that in a pre-K or preschool program?
Well, as your caller indicated, Larry, yes, there is evidence that learning a second language early on helps predict other kinds of facets of student achievement. And certainly, as Priska mentioned, much of early brain growth occurs before age 3, age 4. So to the extent we can introduce a second language as another form of cognitive stimulation, of mental development, that sort of language approach is certainly advantageous for young kids.
Amelia in South Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
Thank you. I used to work for a program in LAUSD where credentialed teachers taught alongside the classroom teacher to pre-K children because of what the professor from Berkeley was saying. We wanted to introduce early teaching skills, and we also treated the question of nutrition and exercise as well as, the brain development. And it was very effective, but because the program, if the parent wanted to have the pre-K child participate, they signed a contract where they, too, would participate once a week for 10 weeks in the classroom. And because the credentialed teachers working with the parents were working alongside the classroom teachers. However, LAUSD closed, a very effective program.
All right. Amelia, I appreciate it. Alan in Van Nuys called to echo exactly what you're saying. He said, my wife was a pre-K teacher in the L.A. district. They used to have a great program for pre-K, but they took away mandatory parental involvement. The kids that went through my wife's program, a majority of them are already attending college, Alan in Van Nuys. So he's reinforcing what our caller just said. Priska, I know this is a challenge, though, for in public schools mandating parental involvement. Private schools do that all the time.
Yeah. It certainly as a mandate. But, when you look at programs like the home visiting programs, which there is also funding for in this budget, those are really just programs that encourage parents and just try to make sure that they understand all that's going on in the early years of life, understand the importance of talking, reading, and singing, understand the importance of those early interactions, and that is learning, that those interactions that you have with your parent and caregiver, that's what early education looks like. So I think that, especially, studies that have looked at home visiting programs have showed a payoff just because when you instill that in parents in the early years, there is more involvement once you get into the formal education, what we think of as formal education. Once you understand, that your child is constantly soaking things in and learning, you may want to be more involved down the road.
Those little sponges. Priska, right. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Priska Neely is KPCC Senior Early Childhood Reporter. Her beat will be a busy one in this first year of Governor Gavin Newsom's term in office. My thanks to Kim Patillo Brownson of First 5 LA, David Wolf of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, Bruce Fuller, UC Berkeley education professor, and Neil McCluskey of the Cato Institute in Washington. Coming up, we're going to talk about other aspects of Governor Newsom's budget proposal in higher education and more. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and I sure hope to see you in person. Coming up at our Film Week Academy Awards preview, our annual program, back at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. All of our Film Week critics on stage, clips of all the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures, and it'll be a great chance for members of our audience to ask questions of our critics as well. We'd love to have you there. Last year's program sold out at the Ace. Get your tickets now. KPCC.org/in-person. Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel. I sure hope to see you there. Joining me now are two of KPCC's reporters closely on the release of Governor Newsom's budget, Michelle Faust-Ragavan, who is a KPCC healthcare reporter, and Adolfo Guzman-Lopez, KPCC higher education reporter. Adolfo, let me start with you. What is Governor Newsom proposing for higher ed funding?
Well, Larry, there's a lot of expectation that Newsom will be the higher education governor. He was very visible at the UC Regents meetings when he was lieutenant governor and the Cal State trustees, Cal State board meetings, mostly around the issue of tuition increases. So he spoke out very strongly against tuition increases years ago. And so, people are expecting both the advocates, administrators, and people around higher education are expecting him to deliver. So, you know, some of the numbers are starting to come in, but there's already an interesting tone that's different from the Cal States. I just got a press release from their office, their central office, that is, you know, welcoming, you know, the proposed, you know, $300 million increase to the Cal State budget.
Wait, I must interrupt you. The Cal State sent out a press release saying they liked a proposed budget?
Well, and that's the thing, Larry. So in previous years where Governor Brown proposed his budget in January, the tone would always be, well, we requested a certain amount. Governor Brown has not given us what we requested. We need, you know, that gap is too large for us to continue to do our job of admitting qualified California high school graduates. And as a matter of fact, tens of thousands of qualified high school graduates have been turned away from the Cal State campuses because they don't have enough money.
So so more money there. The Cal State's liking that. There had been talk that the governor might be proposing a free community college or a year of free community college. So,
lots of headlines, Larry. I mean, that doesn't that sound great? Doesn't that look great? Free community college. It's part of a national move. President Obama's governors and administrators of different states have been pushing it. But they're, the devil's in the details. So Governor Newsom proposed about a month ago, yes, that he would fund a second year of community college tuition. But it's not for everybody. It's going to be for full-time students who are there for the first time. And that's really a sliver of the total community college population in California, which is big. It's huge. 2 million people attend community college at the 113 campuses. So really, that is only going to improve the situation for maybe about 10% of the community college student population in the state.
But those are the ones, in many cases, preparing to transfer. So one could see where that would be beneficial with those who would go from there to the CSUs or the UCs.
And there's another benefit that the advocates talk about, that by putting the idea out there that your first 2 years of community college are going to be covered, those who are on the line about applying for college, who are thinking, well, I can't afford it, college is too expensive, I can't go, will be convinced to apply for college and also convinced to apply for financial aid, and will end up going and will end up beginning this path towards the middle class, toward a good paying job and that sort of thing.
Well, and even though it may only be 10% of total enrollment, this sort of, you know, this is a strong rebuttal to the argument that, well, we don't want to be providing free community college for students who are dabbling or not, you know, not taking community college seriously. They should have skin in the game. These would already be students who have a year of their lives in the game.
And this is what advocates are saying 2019 is going to be about. It's going to be about the total cost of college. What does that mean for a USC student who ends up paying more than $50,000 a year in tuition? That's the big ticket item, even for a UC student. But for a community college student who pays about $1,600 in tuition yearly, that's not the biggest cost. It's food, transportation, and rent. So the big debate this year is expected to be about what the total cost of college is for the majority of college students in California, which is community college students. So California is expected to, you know, give more aid to some of these students.
Yeah, I thought I saw something about aid for parents who are themselves college students.
That, and also the Cal Grant system, financial aid is expected to be overhauled to be able to give money not only for tuition, but also for these other costs we're talking about.
A KPCC reporter, Rodolfo Guzman Lopez, with me, covers higher education for KPCC. Adolfo, do we know yet about UC funding proposal here?
Not quite yet. I mean, we have the top line numbers, I guess you could call them, $240 million in ongoing general fund for operational costs for the University of California. The University of California is interesting because, you know, it's the premier public university system, not only in the state, but in the United States. I mean, so many Nobel laureates and so much research that comes out of the UC campuses. But the people I've talked to, both students and faculty, are saying that deferred maintenance is one of the big deals there. That I talked to the president of the UC Students Association. She attends UCSD. And she was telling me that she's seen students taking tests and the chair breaks right underneath them, that, you know, it really is feeling to a lot of students like they're attending substandard classrooms and buildings. So that's something that the University of California is going to have to deal with, if not this year, definitely in the coming years.
Adolfo, thanks so much. We appreciate your updating us on Governor Newsom's proposed budget. Adolfo Guzman-Lopez, also back with us today. Michelle Faust-Raghavan, who covers healthcare for KPCC. We talked yesterday, Michelle, about some of what was here for the Medi-Cal expansion. What are we looking at?
Well, again, the things that the governor has already laid out that we've already talked about a little bit is that he's putting forward that he wants to have complete coverage, everyone covered in the state of California. And he says that he's paving a way for single payer health care. It says it right here in this budget summary that we got just an hour ago. And with that, there's a few things that are happening. We talked about people who are living in the state without legal immigration documentation. $260 million to get Medi-Cal, regardless of your immigration status, up to age 26. We already do that up to age 19 in the state of California, but expanding it up to that age 26. And then for folks that are not in that population, maybe people at a little bit higher who are not getting those federal subsidies, who are trying to buy healthcare on Covered California, I actually looked at that just to kind of look at it and kind of see what would it be if I wasn't working here at KPCC? What would it cost me? And those premiums were quite high, and I would not qualify for any of those federal subsidies. The governor wants to now put the cap on those subsidies is 400% of the federal poverty limit. Now he wants to cover people from 400 to 600%. So that's $150,000 a year for a family of four. You know, in California, when you talk about federal poverty, you know, being at $150,000 for a family of four is very different than if you in California than like in Kansas.
Yeah, absolutely true. And I'm sorry, I missed it. How much money then? You mentioned $260 million for the Medi-Cal expansion up to age 26 for undocumented residents. And how much would go into the subsidies? Did he break that out?
So when I was looking in the summary, I didn't see the number in here. But I will tell you that last year it was $500 million that was allocated in a bill to do just that, that did not make it to the budget. And we know that Governor Brown was a lot more conservative fiscally when it came to especially some of these healthcare things. And the new governor, Governor Newsom, he said in his opening statements when he was talking about this is my budget, I had to write down the quote. He said, this budget is primarily two things, education and health and human services.
So, yeah, and let's just say hypothetically, because we don't have the number, let's say it's $500 million or close to it in more people qualifying for subsidies on California's ACA version, $260 million on expanding Medi-Cal. So there you got over $750 million just right there in those two healthcare initiatives. A lot of money.
Right. The other thing is, as we mentioned before, the individual mandate. Everyone in California is now going to have to buy health insurance. More people will be getting help with that, but we'll see how that works out.
And do we know the penalties yet, or is that still to be announced?
It has not been announced yet, but it is written out here in this summary of the budget.
All right. Michelle, thank you so much. Adolfo, thank you as well. Great to have you with us on Air Talk on 89.3. Coming up, Terry Gross talks with Kevin Hart, comedian and actor, his new movie, The Upside, as well as him stepping down from hosting the Oscars. That on the table for conversation as well. Fresh Air with Terry Gross, Kevin Hart, coming up next. Have a great day.